Arjun Singh fears for its future.
If you're having people waiting 12 hours in waiting rooms before they're seen by a doctor, if you're having people having heart attacks and strokes in A&E waiting rooms before they're seen, well, that is a system that has collapsed. And the reason that it has collapsed is in large part because we've not funded our workforce properly. We can't retain doctors. You can't have a hospital and an NHS if your doctors are leaving so frequently.
According to the British Medical Journal, 4 in 10 junior doctors in the UK plan to leave the NHS as soon as they can find another job, at home or abroad. But while the trench warfare continues, delayed appointments have reached the 1 million mark, with the NHS's waiting list already at an estimated 7.6 million.
If the government has any hope of these doctors giving up their industrial action anytime soon, then today's double doctor strike should be a sign that that is simply not going to happen.
With both sides digging in their heels, the strikes could continue into another crippling winter. And for patients on the long waiting list, that could potentially mean months of more misery. Saeed Puraza, London.
Palestinians keep descending further into poverty and de-development under the Israeli occupation. In a report released on Monday, the World Bank said poverty rates are stubbornly high, as roughly one out of four Palestinians live below the poverty line. Palestinian non-governmental organizations say the poverty is more severe in Gaza.
In Gaza, the situation is more and more catastrophic comparing to the West Bank. Due to the blockade imposed for the 16 years, we have high deterioration on the humanitarian conditions, also on the economic standards. Due to this blockade, we have food insecurity.
They say that the Israeli occupation and blockade are the main culprits behind the increase in poverty among Palestinians. The Abu Ajwa family in Gaza's Zaytun neighborhood, where more than a dozen people reside, their average daily income is only around $5 a day. The abject poverty has forced them to live in miserable conditions.
Look at my house. It is falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. You can't even imagine how hard it is for me or for my family. Our living conditions and those of many families here are disastrous. We can hardly afford to put food on the table. Poverty has taken its toll on us, and I don't see any improvement to our situation anytime soon.
The situation of the Abu Ajwa family is just a small example of how thousands of people live in the tiny territory. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive as their incomes continue to dwindle. More than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been living under intensified access restrictions since 2007 and are largely isolated from the outside world.
The people who are in need for humanitarian assistance, 80% of the population, and most of them children, women, elders, who are in bad need for such assistance on time, we are suffering from shortage of funding for humanitarian aid. This will lead for more deterioration in the humanitarian and socio-economic situation.
Daily life is a constant struggle for most Gazans because of the inhumane Israeli practices.
According to experts, the Israeli regime is responsible for the high poverty rate and the near collapse of Palestine's economy, as well as its isolation from the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
According to the EU's own official data, 74% of small and medium-sized businesses within the 27-country bloc cannot find skilled workers. At the same time, millions of young people are unemployed. EU Youth Affairs Ministers met on Monday and Tuesday to discuss the crisis.
I think it's very obvious that we have a generation of young people who have been living through crisis after crisis since 2008. The financial crisis, the COVID pandemic, and now they're going through the consequences of a war at the heart of Europe.
The neglect of young adults in the EU was acknowledged last week in the European Parliament.
8 million young people are neither in employment, nor in education, nor in training. 8 million. Their dreams put on hold, their lives on standby.
Youth ministers have agreed to coordinate efforts across the EU to try and fix broken education systems.
Uno. One in every six Europeans has mental health problems. Not just young people, but also older people connected to loneliness and isolation, for example. Every European with mental health issues has a right to access help mechanisms.
It's a right, but experts say help is often unavailable. Apparently, there's a need to prioritise funding.
We have debts and deficits, so the challenge really is how to reconcile this continuous pressure on public budgets, which health is placing, with the broader macroeconomic context.
It is being suggested that allowing young people to fall through the cracks while focusing all resources on the war in Ukraine threatens the future of the entire EU project. According to campaign groups advocating for the rights of young people, the inability of the political establishment in the EU to bring about job opportunities is translating into growing support for extreme anti-EU political parties. It's thought this disquiet will become clearly evident in 9 months from now, when a record number of Eurosceptic candidates are forecast to be successful during European Parliament elections. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After years of negotiations, the European Commission has finally taken a position on the migrant issue, the harshest one. Brussels will, in fact, back the Italian far-right government's hardline stance on migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has welcomed a 10-point plan on migrants presented by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Lampedusa on Sunday.
I'm confident the issue of migration will be added to the agenda of the next EU summit in October. We must stop departures from Africa and swiftly deport those turned down for asylum. The future of Europe is at stake here.
Following a surge in migrant arrivals on Italy's shores, von der Leyen visited the southern island of Lampedusa on Sunday, where the situation has been tense since the start of the year, with thousands of migrants stranded in difficult conditions. Here, von der Leyen announced a new migrant action plan, which includes fighting trafficking, returning migrants to the countries of origin, and transferring migrants from Italy to other EU member states.
It is very important for me because irregular migration is a European challenge and it needs a European answer. So we are in this together.
Germany has promptly expressed its support for another proposal made by the European Commission President von der Leyen that concerns expanding air and naval surveillance of the European Union's external borders. Some experts are of the idea that such a measure would be against international maritime law, as EU ships would not be allowed to operate in territorial zones where only North African states have jurisdiction.
Air and naval surveillance of the Mediterranean by the EU would be equivalent to a warlike act. We all know what has happened to Libya after the French-led NATO attack there. All migrants' countries of origin must be involved in a more democratic process of handling the migrants. Also, von der Leyen's 10-point plan on migrants is full of inconsistencies.
Meanwhile, French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin made a lightning visit to Italy on Monday. In an interview to a French radio, Darmanin said that France is willing to help Italy to secure its borders, but it will not take in any migrants from the island of Lampedusa. Max Civili, Rome.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
According to the latest data from around the United States, the number of homeless people across the country spiked by about 11% this year, the largest jump in more than 15 years when the government first started tracking the data. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Wall Street Journal has covered this story and tells us more. The United States has seen the biggest ever spike in homeless people living on the streets, as preliminary figures showed a record 11% increase in 1 year. According to the Wall Street Journal, there are nearly 600,000 rough sleepers across cities and towns in America, and the jump from 2022 to 2023 so far is the highest since the government started tracking the data in 2007. Places like Oakland and San Francisco in California have become hotbeds for homelessness, as people living on the streets are like drug tourists who arrive to have easy access to narcotics. The numbers keep increasing year on year in Los Angeles and also in Seattle, Washington. Using data from 300 entities that count the number of homeless people in different vicinities, the Wall Street Journal estimated 577,000 people are sleeping rough so far this year, compared with 582,462 in the whole of 2022. Last year's total was up dramatically from the 380,630 recorded in 2021, a total, the Wall Street Journal says, is lower because of pandemic counting disruptions. The Department of Housing and Urban Development is expected to publish formal figures this year, but a preliminary study has shown how the issue of crime, drug abuse, and lack of housing has exacerbated the number of homeless people. And the chronic homeless number for 2022, categorized as people who have a disabling condition who have been unhoused for a year or more, was 138,361. This was up from 64,278 in 2021, again thought to be lower than normal due to pandemic counting disruptions. During the pandemic, there were relief programs in place across the United States to purportedly ease the burden of housing issues, including eviction bans for renters. But now, with these schemes petering out, homelessness has become a more acute problem. Costs and the lack of available housing are also big issues, as well as the migrant crisis. In city centers like New York City An average of 2,300 migrants from the border arrive weekly, putting a strain on housing and forcing many to take to the streets. Just recently, hundreds of people were forced to sleep outside the Roosevelt Hotel in Midtown Manhattan for days while seeking temporary housing facilities. According to latest data, in Oakland, California, the homeless population has grown to over 5,000, a 50% increase since 2015. The devastating homeless crisis is also tormenting downtown Los Angeles, where filthy, ramshackle tent cities are plagued by zombie-like residents smoking drugs, while others hawk stolen goods on street corners. Los Angeles Homeless Service Authority reported there are currently an estimated 42,260 people sleeping rough in the city of Los Angeles, a startling 10% rise compared to just last year. Just recently, it emerged that the city had resorted to sending mobile teams with oxygen cylinders to Skid Row in a desperate bid to prevent overdoses amid its crippling opioid crisis. Workers from the non-profit organization Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles are now patrolling the streets among snaking lines of makeshift dwellings where homeless people can be seen sleeping among the few belongings that they own, as others in dire health inject or smoke illicit substances. The number of homeless people in Los Angeles has more than doubled in the past decade, according to the latest data from the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. There was a 9% rise in homelessness in Los Angeles County between 2022 and 2023, with the unhoused population now totaling 75,518 people. The city of Los Angeles saw an estimated 10% rise to a total of 46,260 people. And in Seattle, Washington, residents were furious after hundreds of tiny homes meant to house the homeless sit locked up in storage while sprawling homeless encampments grow. The King County Regional Homelessness Authority, the agency tasked with coordinating homeless services in the city, has been put on blast for the delay in deploying the miniature homes. Cuomo News revealed that there are at least 204 unused homes that are locked up and kept guarded by a fence, leaving people to sleep on the streets. The homeless population in Seattle grew by nearly 38% from 2020 to 2022, with about 7,620 people reported to be living outside in King County. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. San Francisco, California, one of the most popular and thriving cities of the United States, an economic powerhouse and one of its biggest states, is facing a host of serious issues, with a shrinking population reflecting its multiple woes. A drug epidemic and a rise in the number of homeless people, due in large part to rents that are out of reach for most people, have led to future prospects for the bustling city to be mixed at best. Fentanyl, a highly potent opioid drug, 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine, has wreaked havoc nationwide, but hit San Francisco harder than most. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the city might be poised to exceed a record 700 deaths per year for 2023, only 3 years after the last deadly threshold was reached. The drug overdose epidemic appears to have been concentrated in the city's Tenderloin district, where Mayor London Breed declared an official state of emergency in December of 2021. Furthermore, New York City officials warned of a tipping point in the city's immigration crisis, with asylum seekers making up more than half of the record-breaking 100,000 people housed in the Big Apple's homeless shelters. New York City officials recently said the number of homeless people in New York City shelters has surpassed 100,000, a record high number they attributed to migrants coming from U.S. southern border. The city's deputy mayor told the New York Times the number of migrants in shelters passed 50,000 a few days earlier. More than two-thirds of them are made up of families with children. City Hall Press Secretary Fabian Levy says the city had reached a tipping point. Levy called for more support from the state and federal government, saying it was now caring for more asylum seekers than long-time New Yorkers experiencing homelessness. Under Mayor Eric Adams, New York City officials claimed he has spent more than $1 billion to shelter migrants since they started arriving in large numbers in early 2022. They asserted the costs are set to reach $4.4 billion by next year. Mayor Eric Adams has called the immigration crisis a disaster and claimed his administration has opened 174 emergency shelters and intake centers. As well as housing the homeless in the city's regular shelters, officials have had to spend eye-watering sums on taking over hotels and other venues to house at least 17,000 unsheltered migrants. Earlier this year, New York City Mayor Eric Adams visited the U.S.-Mexico border and called the situation a disaster that needed to be addressed at the federal level.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Baluchistan and Thous Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 11, 2023. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon the Master Muhammad and his pure immaculate progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth, Imam al-Mahdi Ajjalallah. I would like to first welcome each and every one of the brothers and sisters who have traveled a long way to come here. You have blessed our Hosseiniya with your warm presence and your kind, loving hearts. Thank you, my dear brothers and sisters. Seeing you, the dear people of Birjan and Thous Khorasan and the people of Sistan and Baluchistan brings back memories for me. What I am going to share with you is not because I just want to speak about a part of history. Rather, I would like to discredit the false image that the enemies of this nation present about some regions in the country. I want to clarify the truth for the public about our brothers and sisters who live in different parts of the country.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
My first open battle with the Taghuti Pahlavi regime took place in Birjan. I had been active before that as well, but there had not yet been open public confrontations. My first public confrontation took place in Birjan in 1342 AHL 1963 in the month of Muharram. That was about 60 years ago, and most of you weren't born yet. My second confrontation took place in Zahedan. When was that? It was during the month of Ramadan, that same year in 1362, according to the solar Hijri calendar. So you see, the memory I have from the regions goes back to that time. It is not a matter of 10 or 20 years. It is from over half a century ago. In Birjan, they arrested me on the day of Tasua, 9th of Muharram. They detained me in the police station. The people of Birjan wanted to attack the police station on the day of Ashura to get me out of there. That is the decision they had come to. The late Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Tahami's acumen did not allow that to happen. He was a top-level prominent scholar in Birjan. He was a great religious scholar, and if he had been in the Qom or the Najaf seminary, he definitely would have become a marja taqlid or religious authority. But he had come to Birjan and remained there.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A change seems to be on the horizon as some African states are uniting and saying enough is enough to exploitation, colonialization, and degradation. According to a security pact signed on Friday, any attack on the sovereignty and territorial integrity of one or more contracting parties shall be considered as aggression against the other parties and shall give rise to a duty of assistance, including the use of armed force to restore and ensure security. Now, this is the security pact that three of the Sahel countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, have signed. We're going to be taking a look at what it all means on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Abiyomi Azikiwe, editor Pan-African Newswire, out of Detroit. And Netford Freeman, Coordinating Committee member, Black Alliance for Peace, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with me. Well, I'm going to start off in Detroit. And Abiyomi, I mean, since the Berlin Conference in 1844, when Europeans divided Africa amongst themselves, putting arbitrary lines and boundaries and even dividing some tribes, same tribes, Africans have had difficulty in uniting. In your opinion, how significant has the role of colonialism been in keeping African nations divided?
It's been essential because the attempts by the European imperialist powers were all centered around a strategy of divide and conquer. We saw this during the period of the national liberation movements when they attempted to divide the various freedom fighters based upon regional as well as nationality differences. However, during the 1960s and 1970s, there were alliances that were formed. You had CONCEP, which was a coalition of anti-Portuguese colonialist groups, principally in Southern Africa, but also included Guinea-Bissau.
Right.
There was the Southern African Development Community. Today, we have a critical situation, and particularly in the Sahel region in West Africa. The Leptako-Gourma Charter, which was signed yesterday by Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, breaks ground, moving in a very positive and progressive direction, because these countries are under threat, principally from France, but also from the United States as well, even though
okay.
the U.S.
We're going to get into that a little bit further. Let me get Netfa in on this discussion. Netfa, what are the main tactics, one of the main tactics of the colonialists and imperialists has been to put their own person in power of the majority of African nations. And if there was a leader who really wanted to help his people, he was overthrown, imprisoned, or simply killed. The situation in these three countries seemed to be different this time around. What do you think?
Yeah, yes, it's different this time around in the sense that there's been an emerging of forces that are not only, well, they're decidedly anti-France, and that they're not being handpicked because they performed a military takeover of the existing governments that were in the favor of both France and the United States. And right now they're also being, will you say, boosted and supported by the masses of the people who are cheering them in the streets relentlessly. We're seeing a decidedly anti-France because of the traditional colonizing disposition or role that France played. We're not seeing as much the same with the U.S. because it doesn't have that, but things can quickly turn. Hopefully they, in my view, I think it should turn to understand
well, let me just jump in here. How dangerous is that perspective, Netfa? Because you said there is showing a definite anti-French perspective, the people in the street, but not so much anti-United States. Is that dangerous for their movement?
Well, I believe so, in the sense that the undergirding thing is neocolonialism, as our previous guest, Baimi Azikiwe, pointed out. Well, it was neocolonialism, the structure of neocolonialism. The United States is the dominant neocolonial power in the world. And to really rid, if the objective is not just to get rid of the former colonizer, and it's to rid yourself of neocolonialism as the prevailing political and economic order, then the United States has to be included in that.
Okay, well, Abiyomi, let's talk about the significance of this security pact in general, which has been signed by these three countries, in your perspective.
I think it's tremendously historic because they're under threat. They're attempting to get the economic community of West African states, led by Nigeria today, to mobilize a military intervention inside the country. It has not been successful so far due to the widespread unity within all three countries and among all these three states. However, at the same time, there's widespread opposition within the other ECOWAS states as well. In Nigeria, the Senate has opposed any military intervention. Political parties have signed a statement jointly opposing any type of military intervention. And you raised the issue about the United States. They'll have to confront the United States because the U.S., as Netfa pointed out, is the dominant neocolonial power internationally. But France works as a subservient neocolonial power. It's very limited what they can do without the support and assistance of Washington.
Netfa, part of this pact says that even if armed force is necessary, it will be used to ensure security. What is this really saying, especially when we talk about France, which has not ruled out invading Niger?
So there's a lot of the three countries actually face a lot of, and we already, you know, touched on it already, a lot of threats that are external and even kind of internal. The violent extremism, which also the pact is designed to address as well, the jihadists that really are a product of the U.S. and pretty much the product of the U.S., particularly in the destruction of Libya in 2011, which spread that, you know, element across the Sahel. But those elements are still there. Unfortunately, Niger is in a difficult position because it also has this big, you know, the United States has invested a lot with multi-million dollars of drone bases and military bases there. But there's two things, and because we also realizing that while Niger has kicked out the France and is in the and going to expel, wants to expel the ambassadors and everything, it has permitted the resuming U.S. to be able to resume its operations there. I can't judge what that means. It could be one that they are don't want to earn the ire of the added the ire of the U.S., which really has no intention of going anywhere either. And also the fact that maybe there's some intelligence value in terms of their drone. There's both surveillance and defense drones that are used that they can also get from to fight off the jihadist elements that are there. So it's complicated. Niger is in a complicated situation. It doesn't, you know, diminish the fact that the U.S. really has to be eliminated from Africa. But this is a complicated situation. But I do agree that the pact is very good. And in the instance that either France or through ECOWAS or even if the United States decided to have some military action, that pact would have to make a decision to even defend themselves against something like that.
Well, Abayomi, what is your perspective about ECOWAS? It's been talked about a couple of times already in this program. Your overall perspective about this group?
In theory, it's a positive development. It started in around 1975 and was promoted by people like the late President Ahmed Sekoutouré of the Republic of Guinea. Since that time period, however, they have fallen victim to the same neocolonial narrative. Today, for example, with the chairmanship of ECOWAS being in the hands of Nigeria, the president there, Bola Tinubu, unfortunately, has taken a pro-U.S. position, a pro-France position, and was willing to use his own troops and the troops of other regional states to militarily intervene in the affairs of a neighbor. Niger shares a northern border with Nigeria. Population is about 25 million people, 10 times smaller than that of neighboring Nigeria. Unfortunately, ECOWAS has fallen victim to the same pro-imperialist outlook that others have fallen victim to. But that can change if there's a movement, a strong anti-imperialist movement, which exists right now and is expanding in West Africa, that can easily be reversed. They've suspended the three states that have had these military changes in power. Nonetheless, the masses of people in West Africa right now are becoming more and more political conscious.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Nedfa, I mean, we know ECOWAS had threatened Niger but didn't attack. Again, sort of there are talks about the possibility. Do you think that at the end of the day, ECOWAS will attack on behalf of the French? Because they are, the French are definitely trying to get them to do their dirty work for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really hard to say. It really wouldn't be in the interest of these, what we refer to as the comprador leaders of these countries. They've already experienced, like was just alluded to, a backlash in their countries for even suggesting that they're supporting the French in this. And so, and even some of them have had to make, you know, have sought to make purges in their military because they thought they were going to end up being subjected to the same fate as and being taken over. It wouldn't be in their best interest, but at the same time, as a comprador class, those that are really doing the exist at the for the interest of outside powers, they really are in a rock and a hard place because it's either go the way of supporting your people and doing the right thing, or being ousted for supporting the imperialists. But they, you know, they're not going to change in terms of politically to start working for the mass of the people. So they're really in a right. It's hard to predict something like that. I think at the end of the day, they may. I don't know. That's the answer.
What would that mean? I mean, Abayomi, because if ECOWAS would actually attack, and now with this pact that has been signed yesterday, what would that mean for the region?
The governments that will be leading this military intervention would be endangered by their own people. A lot of these regimes are very fragile, even including Nigeria, even though it's considered the largest economy on the African continent. There's tremendous economic and social problems in existence there. For example, the trade union movement just over a week ago had a nationwide strike there against the rising inflation. Nigeria has failed to build oil refineries, and they've lifted subsidies on fuel. So the inflation rate is enormous, and this is happening in many other African states. So if they allow France or the United States to prompt them to militarily intervene in neighboring states, they themselves could easily be overthrown by the military with the support of the majority of the people within those societies.
Well, Netfa, what do you think about the possibility of the French attacking directly Niger?
I would not rule it out. I think we'd be naive to rule it out. France heavily depended on Niger and all of these, all of the neocolonial states. For them, the collapse of neocolonialism in Africa, for them, and their role, its role is sustaining electricity, all kind of the economy of France is huge. And so they really, so we wouldn't want to underestimate the desperation that they may be feeling by having to lose their, being faced with the threat of losing their neo colonies. So I don't, you know, it's something that I think is a real possibility. However, it also suggests that it's going to be a regional situation, and may even, I don't know, international conflicts could emerge from this in terms of the global South versus the global North.
What are the chances that we will see a rise in terrorism in the region, as some Western countries have been accused of using terrorists to usher in their own goals whenever needed, and that would be a way to, of course, destabilize?
It's already going on right now in northern Mali. There's been a resurgence of some of the Tuareg rebel groups in their attacks against the government in Bamako. It's also happened in Niger, as well as Burkina Faso. In regard to France, it's been accusations made that they are funding the Boko Haram insurgent group in northeastern Nigeria. France is desperate, as Detfa pointed out. The president, Emmanuel Macron, said just 2 days ago that the ambassador there, the French ambassador to Niger, who has been asked to leave several weeks ago, is being held hostage. Now, that is a complete lie, but these are the type of provocative accusations that are being made to perhaps justify some type of a commando strike on Niamey, the capital of Niger.
Well, you mentioned about the accusation and that they're holding the ambassador hostage after Niger has demanded that he leaves. I mean, let's talk about the arrogance, Netva, on the part of the French. Isn't that part of the problem, has always been the problem to begin with, that they have never seen the Africans or African countries as equals, but looking at them in a very derogative or less than position?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a disposition inherited from colonization and white supremacy of colonization. And being the France has had some of the most pervasive clutches in terms of their former, I won't even say former colonies, but current present neo-colonies, like, for example, the imposition of the CFA franc, this currency that they impose on the African countries, their former colonies. And then also, I mean, Frank Macron was said something very arrogant. He was saying that the Africa just recently was said the African countries aren't able to manage their own affairs. This kind of disposition has always been the sort of white man's burden type of thing that has come along with colonization. We're here to civilize you, and you're not able to do things on your own, and so our domination of you is basically for your own good. So the arrogance, that same arrogance, and coupled with their desperation as well, we're not going to leave. We don't recognize what the masses of the people are supporting because they don't know any better. We're not even going to leave. And then, you know, so they can claim things like all kinds of lies. The ambassador's being held hostage, when in fact, if the situation is if he comes out of the embassy, they would be escorted outside of the country, which is what the Africans should be in their right to do. It's like we don't want you here. We should be able to expel you from our country.
Right. Well, Abayomi, we've seen in the past we've had African leaders who really try to help their people, and we know what happened to them. How likely is it right now? Assassination plots, these type of things, especially with these leaders who've signed the security pact?
We can be very certain that these conspiracies are well underway. You've mentioned the historical attacks that have been made on Pan-African leadership. Patrice Lumumba is a good example. Felix Mumi from the Cameroon. Mm-hmm. We had the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah in 1966. There's been so many. Thomas Sankara, who was overthrown in 1987 at the aegis of French imperialism. So, yes, I'm sure the leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger are very aware of these plots that are going on, and that's why they're signing these agreements to intensify their military cooperation as well as intelligence coordination.
Netva, what is making this era different from before? Why have we witnessed several coups, and they're all very anti-French, and condemning Paris for its exploitation of the continent? It's not as if the exploitation just started. So what has brought all of this together to where we are today, in your perspective?
Well, I think, you know, nothing like this can last, sustain itself forever. But then also the generations now have the benefit of hindsight. We have legacies of freedom fighters and even those who have done things like Thomas Sankara, for example, in Burkina Faso, who led a coup and then turned it around and created a very formidable socialist society that was benefiting the mass of the people. Now, there's a saying that they used to have, and I think it was said a lot around you can kill the lion, but what will you do with the cubs? So as generations of feeder fighters before us in history and movements on the ground by the young people, like even in the Congo, different French young people have been politicizing their people over time. And this is I think this is the result of it, that no one is going to the global economy, you know, the polarization and intensification of poverty and disparities and all of these things coming together means that something was about to break. And I think these are the positive the positive developments where French is being, you know, kicked out and that the pacts are being created. It's a new historical day. We have the legacy of Pan-Africanism during the 60s, 50s, throughout the 50s to the 70s, mm-hmm. in terms of trying to establish a united African understanding, African unity as being essential to warding off, fending off colonialism and neocolonialism. These things don't just disappear, and we're seeing coming in this form today.
Well, Abayomi Netfer just talked about African unity and alliances. How likely are we to see this spread? We have this pact right now with these three countries, but as we've been talking, a lot of the people inside, a lot of Africans inside of their countries right now are not happy with their governments. How likely are we to see this spread?
It's very likely, and I believe it's going to come from the ground up, meaning from the workers, the farmers, the youth, the revolutionary intellectuals and artists. They're going to be the motivating social forces to build and to renew the Pan-African struggle towards African unification. It's going to be essential because what we see in the Western imperialist countries, for example, France, they have had all types of social problems this year, uprising on the part of the working class over pension reform. We saw the mass rebellions over the summer, over the killing of Nihil, where descendants of African migrants rose up against the French state. So now they have a problem in West Africa. So there's no solution for imperialism in Africa. The only real solution is that the masses rise up, unify, and toss out these imperialist powers and their puppets.
Ned, for your perspective, what needs to happen in these countries for them to reach true independence and have control of their natural resources?
And I think most of it was already said by my colleague Abayomi Zigwe, but I would just maybe the only thing I could add, and maybe it was already implicit in what he said, is that forms of participatory democracy and redistribution of wealth and those kind of projects have to take place. We're seeing some of it even in Burkina Faso, some remnants of efforts in that regard. But eventually, the people have to be able to be running the governments, and they also maybe have to look at different global relationships, international relationships, in which we see with the multipolar world, things like the BRICS and the G77 is going on in Havana, you know, and non-aligned movement, reemerging of that. Those will have to be utilized in terms of international relations.
And on that note, I thank both of you gentlemen for being with me on the Spotlight. Abayomi Azikiwe, editor, Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit. Netford Freeman, coordinating committee member, Black Alliance for Peace out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.